Conversations series, that was a lot to say. The theme this year has focused on cultural politics and political culture. And along the way, we looked at all kinds of interesting topics, like homosexuality in the U.S. left in the mid-20th century, the creation of the federal government's Civil War archives, black authors and the depiction of Reconstruction in the late 19th century. And now we have another perfect kind of political culture topic. We are very fortunate to have one of Boston University's very own faculty members here for our lecture this evening. Deborah Jaramillo is Assistant Professor of Film and Television in the College of Communication. She is the author of Ugly War, Pretty Package, How CNN and Fox News Made the Invasion of Iraq High Concept, as well as numerous articles and essays that deal with topics like the changing image of Mexican narcos on U.S. television, as well as daytime TV soap operas. Next time you'll come and talk about daytime TV soap operas.
I can always talk about soap operas.
Well, maybe we'll ask you about that in the questions. Because who doesn't want to talk about that? She has twice been a Ford Foundation Fellow, and she's on the board of the Texas Archive of the Moving Image. So her talk today, which is drawn from her current book project, you can see the title, The Senator and the Television Industry, William Benton, The Television Code, and the Race to Police Early TV Content. So help me welcome Deborah Jaramillo.
Thank you so much for coming. As you said, the title of my paper is Senator and the Television Industry. At the heart of my investigation into William Benton and his tribulations is my desire to understand why the 1952 television code was drafted so quickly and what the processes and social relations were that led up to the drafting of the 1952 TV code. So it's necessary then to give some background on the code. What did it do? The 1952 television code did two major things. First, it kind of regulated the relationship between advertisers and television stations, and it regulated the acceptability of television content, right? So for our purposes, the most important part of that is the regulation of content, the push to ensure that television content was wholesome, decent, and basically uncontroversial. I'm just going to show you just a few excerpts of the content portions of the code. So no profanity, obscenity, smut, or vulgarity. You have to maintain the sanctity of marriage on television. No cruelty, greed, or selfishness. So if you can just think of the shows that are on now, for instance, that wouldn't have been able to exist at that time.
Nothing. So
no Breaking Bad, right? So no illegal drugs.
Not even Modern Family.
Right. So this one is particularly interesting because it's not only regulating what you could or couldn't say, it was regulating what you could or couldn't show. All right. So this one deals specifically with aesthetics, actually. Mm. So it wasn't just about writing, it was about production as well. And then, of course, costuming had to be proper. So in order to trace the development of the code, which is what my larger book project is, it's necessary to understand the interactions between these folks, all right? The industry, and I'm looking specifically at the National Association of Radio and Television Broadcasters, which had always been known as the National Association of Broadcasters. In 1951, it becomes the NARTB. It drops that in 58, but so we'll be talking about the NARTB today. So hi, Sarah. So NARTB and networks, we need to look at those interactions between them and the government in the form of the FCC and Congress. And we're also taking into account viewers. And I say we because Catherine helped me in a lot of my research. We took a lot of photos of documents at the National Archives and in Wisconsin. So all of these interactions are basically, and using Thomas Streeter's model of understanding regulation as social relations, this is really what the book is all about. So why does the TV code matter now? 62 years after its implementation, over 30 years since its death, and now since we're living in a time of rampant sex, violence, profanity, and more sex on television, all right? So my first long-term research project when I was a PhD student at the University of Texas was focused on cable television, actually, so scripted programming on basic and premium cable. Product differentiation is what propelled networks like HBO, FX, AMC, and Showtime to heights that cable never could have imagined in the 1980s. So something was very different about their original series, and that difference was rooted in industrial circumstances that held broadcast television to a different standard. So what regulations were in place that rendered broadcast TV a pro-social, relatively family-friendly landscape, and that would allow cable television, an unregulated tier of television, to flourish with differentiated programs? In other words, what made cable so damn special? All right. So this is the starting point, actually, for my project now. Recently, and thankfully, there's been a turn in media studies towards a scholarly understanding of media production and media labor. So in many ways, these works deromanticize Hollywood production. They deromanticize the figure of the author that film studies holds so dear. And they do this in order to delve into the cultures of production, the cultures of industry. So my contribution here lies in the cultures of regulation. By understanding the circumstances under which television has been constrained, we can understand how television has been constructed. So government regulation has been studied, but self-regulation has been sidelined for one reason or another. Trade associations, organizations created by common businesses that join forces to affect the direction of an industry, need to enter the narrative of broadcast history, if only because, in a much more pronounced way, if only because we're not dealing with just any industry, right? We're dealing with a culture industry. So the trade association interacts with government officials, other businesses, and the public in order to craft rules that ultimately protect its members from the government, other businesses, and the public, right? So we think about commercial broadcasters, television stations. They want to self-regulate so that they don't have to deal with outsiders. For Harvey Jassem, broadcasters' early regulations, quote, were designed to attend to the concerns of the public, the regulators, and the advertisers, while or so that broadcasters could go about their business in the least fettered and most protected fashion. The ultimate goal of self-regulation is to protect the profit position. So if the Communications Act of 1934 mandated that broadcasters operate in the public interest, how could the industry negotiate that and their commercial imperatives? One way they did this was by creating standards of practice. Right? So most businesses visibly demonstrate their morality and their ethics in the way they conduct their operations, right? Their daily dealings, their interactions. Broadcasters, however, visibly demonstrate their morality and their ethics via a program's content. So the TV code's existence implied that racier or purely entertaining programs might yield higher ratings, all right? They might result in a more successful business operation, but that was not the right way to make money, all right? So pressure from viewers, Congress, and the FCC helped to create an atmosphere in which racier programs needed to be tempered by standards. But imposing standards on content, in other words, fixing the themes and ideas that writers could write about and television stations could broadcast, disrupted a competitive marketplace. How could programs, and thus networks, truly compete with each other if they were bound by the same restrictions of theme, story, and aesthetics? So let's back up and consider the trade associations that were grappling with issues of content. The Television Broadcasters Association was the very first trade association for television. It started in 1943, and the few kind of remaining documents belonging to this organization are proceedings of the conferences they held semi-regularly. And these conferences hosted conversations, really the first major conversations about television's future. So for television, these conversations happened within the context of industry, advertising, target audiences, department stores, and manufacturers. The men who belonged to these associations, they were mostly men, actively shaped how television entered U.S. social life, even as World War II had halted television manufacturing and most broadcasting. And among the conversations they had were debates about television content. In other words, if television content was to be a kind of a proper guest in people's homes, it couldn't be offensive. So they had the typical kinds of conversations about needing to be decent, but the conversations weren't necessarily monolithic. So one representative from Mutual Broadcasting Company, which is a radio network, warned that any kind of aggressive regulation of content, any kind of aggressive standard setting,
would actually wind up stunting television's ability to be experimental, to be creative, to be art, all right? So the TVA members didn't rush to enact a code. They discussed a code, but they didn't kind of jump on it immediately. So when reading the proceedings of the conferences, really I get a sense that there was a much more measured response to calls for decency. Now the thing about the TVA was it was very small, had a small membership, so there weren't a lot of dues coming in, so they didn't have a lot of money. So that left them quite vulnerable. The NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters, for its part, didn't particularly care for TV. Its power and wealth were based on its radio membership. The NAB only had a TV committee, and that TV committee served in an advisory capacity. It had no real power. The main reason the NAB only glanced at TV now and then and failed to commit to a lasting relationship was that its dues-paying radio members didn't want to fund a competitor. So if the NAB had a fully operating TV branch in it, it would be outnumbered by the radio membership, and the radio membership would have to then subsidize TV's infancy in the association. In 1948, mainstream commercial television had launched. By December of that year, the number of television stations in the U.S. had increased to 48, and the number of television sets in homes approached 1 million, and 312 licenses to operate television stations, or 312, rather, applications to run television stations awaited FCC approval. So the TVA forged ahead with television, and as the TV committee of the NAB tried to get the NAB to notice it, complaints about television content started pouring in. As I said, Catherine and I took probably thousands of photos of complaint letters written to the FCC, so I'm just going to show you a couple. This one in particular is kind of interesting because whereas most of the letters complained about crime on television, low necklines, sex, these kinds of things, this one's actually advocating for heteronormativity, all right? This one's saying wrestlers on TV are far too effeminate, all right? So this will give you a sense of some of the range of these letters. This one's a little more typical. This guy is complaining about voluptuous hussies. All right, so mounting complaints...
I love that pairing.
Mounting complaints about TV content coincided with the NAB's growing awareness of TV for its radio membership. So this will just give you a sense. The NAB had 1,305 radio members. Of those, 235 were moving into television rather swiftly, actually. So three things propelled the NAB's embrace of TV. One was the medium's mounting popularity, evidenced by market research. Another was the growing number of NAB members investing in television. And the third was the fact that another trade association had already staked a claim. So the saga of how the TVA lost TV is very long, and that's a whole other chapter. But basically, by 1951, after half-hearted negotiations and massive publicity campaigns, the NAB created an autonomous television branch and renamed itself NARTB, National Association of Radio and Television Broadcasters. The TVA folded immediately, but by erasing the TVA and its efforts from the history of the television industry, the NAB erased alternative ideas about policing content. They also foreclosed on a trajectory that the television industry might have taken had it not been in an association saddled with a radio-dominated history. The same year the TVA dissolved, the newly renamed NARTB drafted and adopted an advertiser-friendly code that attempted to standardize programs as though they were any other kind of consumer product. Regardless of the ineffectuality of the previous radio codes, this is what the NAB knew how to do. They knew how to draft codes. As television was created in the image of radio, it wound up being policed like it too. One of the factors expediting the code was the specter of government intervention embodied by Senator William Benton. So who was William Benton? I'm deeply indebted to Cynthia Meyer's work on Benton's time in radio. Benton worked in advertising agencies since the 1920s. He co-founded his own ad agency with Chester Bowles in 1929 and stayed with it until 1936. Myers writes that in 1933, Benton began to express concern about programming quality, believing that, you know, when programs catered to the desires of advertisers rather than listeners, they were actually degrading the show. So he actually advocated for ejecting advertisers from program building altogether. Remember, this is a time when sponsors controlled radio programs, sponsors built programs, not networks. So Benton wanted to eject advertisers, and he believed that the network should control all the content and just sell minutes to advertisers, as we have now. Myers writes that Benton, as a corporate liberal, felt a need to protect the public from the worst excesses of the free market. So he pursued two initiatives that might secure this protection. The first centered on education. All right. So Benton actively promoted the role of education in building a better world. As a vice president of the University of Chicago and later as owner and operator of the Encyclopedia Britannica, you know, his kind of dramatic career shift demonstrated his ability to look forward to find the public interest in its various manifestations. But the bridge that spanned his old life and his new life was radio. Educational broadcasts, he felt, could really reach people who didn't have access to higher ed institutions. So to that end, he developed educational radio programs at the University of Chicago. But to hear him tell the story in 1951, he, quote, failed miserably in the goal he had set for himself and for radio. Benton's second pet project was subscription radio. All right, so think Sirius XM, but without the satellite technology. He took yet another step away from his time as an ad man to push for a subscription form of radio that sidestepped the commercial presence. This, of course, was not popular with commercial broadcasters, but Benton stood his ground, rightly pointing out that advertising had become the de facto way of doing radio, even though nothing in radio's DNA required commercial support. So it's important to note that Benton was a majority shareholder of Muzak, even during his time as a senator. So his interest in subscription radio, or in subscription to music service, was realized in a non-educational way. In a piece in the Saturday Review of Literature that William Benton wrote entitled Television with a Conscience from August 1951, Benton warned that the impending thaw of the FCC's license freeze would confine television to a paradigm dictated by advertisers. Just to give you some context, in 1948, the FCC realized that the television channel allocation scheme it had come up with placed television channels too close together geographically, or stations too close together geographically. So when you turned on your television set, all you got was static. So there was massive interference. So they basically had to step back. They froze all license applications for television stations. It was only supposed to last a few months, but during that time, they were hearing deliberations about color television, proposals about color TV coming from CBS. So the freeze just kept going on, all right? So what Benton was worried about was that ending the freeze too early would actually halt changes to the structure of commercial television. Decrying program stereotypes and lowest common denominator options, Benton proposed three ways to stop TV from proceeding down what he called the road to trivialization. The first was for networks and stations to air more educational programs. The second was to develop a subscription TV service to compete with the advertiser-supported model. And the third was to grant more educational institutions licenses to run television stations. So he bemoaned the reliance of television upon pure entertainment and crime formulas, arguing that if the medium continued along this path, quote, without guidance from Congress or from organized public opinion, it will never remotely do the great and urgent educational and public service job required by the times. The way to fix the education problem for Benton was to fix the commercial problem. He asked, quote, why not a system in which the viewer orders and pays for what he gets without any advertising whatsoever? We're still asking this question, right? Mm-hmm. Framing subscription TV both as a home-based movie theater, he refers to a box office, and an educational institution, he referred to the service bill as a tuition fee. He envisioned subscription TV not just as a public service, but as a special venue for niche audiences, who he referred to as minorities. While commercial television catered to a mass, Benton suggested that subscription TV could offer class. So he was thinking of operas, plays, etc. So in this piece, Benton encouraged his readers to stay on top of the FCC's allocation of television channels for educational broadcasters. Of the 2,000 stations that the FCC was going to authorize,
209 had been tentatively reserved for non-commercial educational use. So he praised the FCC for those reservations, but he warned that, quote, the powerful NARTB opposed the reservations and predicted that they would be wasted through non-use or partial use. Benton also proposed funding mechanisms, one being the commercial sponsorship of half a day's worth of programming in order to fund the second half of the day's educational shows. Another method was, again, through subscription TV, and he proposed that, you know, universities could sell access to their football games on a pay TV channel, and then that would fund educational programming year-round. In Television with a Conscience, Benton proposed a fourth solution to the TV problem that he believed would buttress his three initial proposals, and that solution was the passage of his bill, Senate Bill 1579, which included the creation of a National Citizens Advisory Board for radio and television. Before Benton introduced S-1579, he submitted Senate Resolution 127, which called for a, quote, quick review and investigation, including the holding of public hearings with respect to several things: the types of programs on television, how the FCC decides to allocate television channels, the control that sponsors have over programming, the funding of educational programming, and what type of legislation would be necessary to make sure that public service programming actually had a place on television. In response to this, the NARTB, in its member bulletin, its bulletin that it sent out to its members, tried to draw a connection between Benton's resolution and the Ford Foundation's $90,000 grant to the Joint Committee on Educational Television. The bulletin did include a caveat at the beginning that, quote, the two developments are not necessarily directly related, but it attempted to provoke a degree of envy by drawing members' attention to the fact that $90,000 was, quote, approximately equal to the total television budget of NARTB at this moment for all activities. Despite the appeals to conspiracy theories and outright jealousy, the bulletin quoted the association's official response to Benton's resolution, making three arguments. First, that the investigation he wanted was essentially redundant. Second, that the Communications Act of 1934 had clearly established the criteria for FCC licensing. And third, and most importantly, that the investigation would postpone the lifting of the television license freeze. So here we see the very significant economic motive for lambasting Benton. The freeze was caging a medium that was set to ascend. Any delay would compound the losses that the television industry had been incurring since the beginning of the freeze in 1948. John Howe, Senator Benton's legislative assistant, solicited advice about the Senate resolution from several well-placed experts and determined that Senator McFarland, who chaired the Senate subcommittee of the Committee for Interstate and Foreign Commerce, would grant Benton a courtesy hearing and then forget the whole thing. Furthermore, Benton was advised that the chance that any new legislation would come from this resolution if passed was almost zero. Educational organizations like the National Association of Educational Broadcasters and the Joint Committee for Educational Television couldn't get behind Benton because, in accepting money from the Ford Foundation, they had to swear before the Internal Revenue Bureau that they wouldn't in any way try to influence legislation. One FCC commissioner conveyed pessimism to Howe because of the FCC's inability to, quote, withstand pressure even with new legislation behind it, citing one case in which a congressman retaliated against an FCC decision by accusing the FCC of issuing a license, a television license, to known communists. And so the result of this was that the FCC lost over $500,000 in appropriations. So the FCC was scared, all right? In addition to all of that going against Benton, the industry was ready to fight. Even more pressing for the television industry than Senate Resolution 127 was S-1579, or the Benton Bill, as it came to be known, which would create a National Citizens Advisory Board on radio and television. Benton and his co-sponsors, Hunt, Bricker, and Saltonstall, submitted 1579 on May 31st, 1951. This is just a description of the National Citizens Advisory Board, or the CAB, as I'll call it. And these are Benton's words, made up of 11 outstanding private citizens drawn from the fields of education and communications and from among leaders in the civic, cultural, and religious life of the nation,
with not one having any financial interest in radio or television. The CAB would review how well radio and television are serving the public interest and issue an annual report to Congress and the FCC. The CAB's most pressing task would be to suggest how radio and television could better serve the public interest. So yes, the CAB would review what was on television, report back to Congress and the FCC, but it would also make recommendations. In other words, it could very well affect television content, all right? So critics wondered why something like the CAB would be necessary if the FCC already regulated broadcasting in the public interest. Benton made it clear that the CAB would in no way supplant the FCC, but he did assume that the CAB would play an important role in influencing legislation and in offering the FCC guidance on license renewal applications. He also stressed the CAB's advisory role, which he felt would protect it from accusations of censorship. Yet, he wrote, its potency should not be underestimated. In August of 1951, Senator Benton and his co-sponsors introduced revised drafts of the Benton Bill and Senate Joint Resolution 76, both of which replaced that initial resolution 127. The adoption of Senate Resolution 76 would mean that the Senate would recommend a few things. They would recommend that TV stations would be continued to be licensed annually, that the FCC should encourage the development of subscription radio, and that the CAB should be established. The principal revision to the Benton Bill to S-1579 pertained to the CAB. In revising the bill, Benton wanted to make it crystal clear, he wrote, that the function of the proposed National Citizens Advisory Board is strictly advisory. Government involvement obviously rattled the industry. So what about a private alternative? In a meeting with the NARTB leadership in July 1951, John Howe revealed that a purely private CAB was impossible because they wouldn't be able to get the money. Only the federal government would be able to, quote, provide not only the machinery, but the funds. At this meeting, Harold E. Fellows, president of the NARTB, assured Howe that Benton would be met only with the NARTB's firm opposition. Benton reached out to network heads, certainly understanding that the interests of the networks were not always aligned with the interests of the NARTB. The networks, in fact, had had a kind of a rocky relationship with the NAB. In a letter to Robert Kintner of ABC, Benton tried to make the case that the CAB would actually help the U.S.'s image abroad. and he further tried to recruit Kintner to, you know, get on board with the cause. He tried to quash the censorship accusations, saying actually having a CAB will make television freer, and that if the CAB had existed before, radio itself would have been much freer than it was. Of course, Benton's outreach to the industry had no effect. Instead, the industry closed ranks, and the NARTB was its mouthpiece. The association listed its concerns in a bulletin relaying the details of the July meeting with John Howe. They worried about the possibility of the CAB becoming a, quote, sprawling bureaucracy, a super censorship board operating in the tradition of the Blue Book, or a government-sponsored pressure group that mandated public service programming. Ultimately, the NARTB asked, just what does Senator Bill Benton want? They answered their own question in a very damaging way just 1 month later. In the September 1st confidential TV newsletter sent to NARTB members, the lead story was dedicated to Benton in light of the hearings on the Benton Bill. Characterizing the CAB as, quote, one of the most potentially devastating legislative guns ever leveled at the radio television industry, they love hyperbole. the piece calls for all broadcasters to unite in opposition to legislation that could lead to what they called a super censorship board. The bulletin that the NARTB sent out in a very savvy way used the rights of viewers to make their case, writing, quote, the rights of the mass of viewers and listeners would be abrogated to the extent that a super board would determine that certain televised and broadcast programs liked by viewers and mass were not proper for them. So this is like the TV version of death panels, all right? So who would look out for a viewer's right to choose if not the NARTB? They clearly did not acknowledge that by denying alternatives to commercial TV, they were actively limiting viewers' choices. This same NARTB bulletin then takes an ugly turn, leveling some serious accusations against Benton and his associates. First, the bulletin asserts that the revised Benton Bill was drafted by former FCC Chair Paul Porter and Porter's law partner, Harry Plotkin, who used to work as a lawyer for the